The Meaning of Marxism by Paul D'Amato. Chapter 1. From Millenarianism to Marx. Section Header. The Dream of a New Society. The idea of socialism is as old as class society itself. So long as there were high priests, kings, lords, nobles, emperors, magistrates, and generals, there were also people who envisioned, and sometimes fought for, a world in which the minority who enriched themselves at the expense of the majority would fall, and the world's wealth would be held in common and shared by all. Often, radical ideas were couched in religious form, but their content was nonetheless unmistakable. Quote, "Grace was among them, because none suffered lack. For they did not give one part and retain another part for themselves. They abolished inequality and lived in great abundance," wrote the Patriarch of Constantinople, St. John Chrysostom, in the late 4th century of Christ's apostles. The 14th century English radical preacher, John Ball, a leader in the Great Agrarian Rebellion of 1381, sermonized, quote, "If we are all descended from one father and one mother, Adam and Eve, how can the Lord say or prove that they are more lords than we are? Say they make us dig and till the ground so that they can squander what we produce. They are clad in velvet and satin, set off with squirrel fur, while we are dressed in poor cloth. They have beautiful residences and manners, while we live the trouble and the work, always in the fields, under rain and snow. But it is from us and our labor that everything comes, and with which they maintain their pomp." End quote. He concluded from this that things cannot go well in England, nor ever shall, until all things are in common, and there is neither villein, i.e. serf, nor nobile, but all of us are of one condition. Seeing that the French Revolution of 1789 ended feudal tyranny, but not economic equality, inequality between rich and poor, nor the rule of the wealthy, Gracchus Babeuf organized a conspiracy of equals and called for a new revolution to establish a society in which all goods would be held in common storehouses and distributed according to need. "Everything will be blended together," he wrote, "and on the footing of perfect equality." The United States had its share of radical thinkers, utopians, and socialists before Marx. For example, Thomas Skidmore, author of The Rights of Man to Prosperity, wrote in the 1820s, "Inasmuch as great wealth is an instrument which is uniformly used to extort from others their property, it ought to be taken away from its possessors on the same principle that a sword or pistol may be wrested from a robber." Skidmore believed that the new inventions, like the steam engine, though, quote, "likely to greatly impoverish or destroy the poor," could be beneficial to them on the condition that they, quote, "lay hold of it and make it their own." Emerging industrial capitalism had its insightful critics before Marx. The Swiss economist Jean-Charles Léonard Simon de Sismondi wrote in the 1830s, quote, "Exertion today is separated from its recompense. It is not the same man that first works and then reposes, but it is because the one works that the other rests." Sismondi grasped the essence of all class societies. It is not simply that some are wealthy and others are not. It is the labor of the many that accounts for the wealth of the few. In the years following the Great French Revolution, a group of socialists emerged who came to be known as utopians. The utopian socialists were known for concocting plans and schemes for a rationally organized society. Brilliant critics of the iniquities of industrial capitalism, which they argued worked against the better part of human nature, the utopians sought to create islands of social or communal living that would set an example for the rest of the world to follow. Their aim was to convince everyone, including the wealthy, of the superiority of their system. Human reason, the sheer logic of their position, would convince the well-born in society to adopt their plans. Indeed, the French utopian Charles Fourier was actually opposed to revolutionary change from below. For the utopians, the working class was only a suffering class, not a class capable of transforming society by its own actions. Engels put it this way, quote, "The solution of the social problems, which as yet lay hidden in undeveloped economic conditions, the utopians attempted to evolve out of the human brain. Society presented nothing but wrongs. To remove these was the task of reason. It was necessary, then, to discover a new and more perfect system of social order, and to impose this upon society from without by propaganda, and, wherever it was possible, by the example of model experiments. These new social systems were foredoomed as utopian. The more completely they were worked out in detail, the more they could not avoid drifting off into pure fantasies." End quote. Virtually all of these utopian experiments, many of which were established in the United States in the 1800s, failed. Rather than changing the wider world, the social and economic priorities of the capitalist world changed them. These experiments, though they sometimes offered a glimpse of alternative ways of organizing society, succumbed to the surrounding hostile capitalist environment. Workers' cooperatives, by the way, have always faced the same problem, that you can't build little islands of socialism in a sea of market capitalism. As Rosa Luxemburg noted, a worker-owned business must, if it is to survive in the market, impose on itself the same exploitative conditions that exist in other capitalist-owned enterprises, or, quote, "if the workers' interests continue to predominate, end by dissolving." Various strands of utopianism remain influential today, often justified on the grounds that such experiments prefigure a better world. The idea that you can create autonomous islands of liberation fails on two accounts. First, because the real world finds a way to impinge, and therefore undermine, the relations that the autonomists try to establish. And second, because they pose no challenge to the capitalist system as a whole by their existence. What made Marx and Engels' socialism different from the utopians? It was that their socialist ideas were rooted in real, rather than ideal, conditions. Marx and Engels showed that the desire for and vision of another world wasn't enough. The utopians, in criticizing existing social relations and proposing elaborate social plans for a better society, simply counterposed what is with what ought to be. But there had to be something that connected the future with the present. The seeds of a future society had to already exist in the soil of the present for it to spring forth. the material conditions, and social actors had to exist to make that change both possible and necessary for society to move forward. Communism is for us, wrote Marx and Engels, not an ideal to which reality will have to adjust itself. It is the real movement which abolishes the present state of things. The starting point for Marx and Engels, therefore, was not, quote, what men say, imagined, conceived, in order to arrive at men in the flesh. Instead, they wrote, we set out from real, active men, and on the basis of their real-life process, we demonstrate the development of the ideological reflexes and echoes of this life process. The point was not that it was impossible to have ideas about freedom before the conditions for their realization existed, or that there was a mechanical one-to-one relationship between people's ideas and their material conditions of life. However, one cannot be liberated if one is unable to obtain food and drink, housing and clothing in adequate quality and quantity. Liberation, Marx and Engels argued, is a historical and not a mental act. Socialism, in short, must be more than a good idea. There must be material and social forces created in the womb of capitalism itself, which have the potential to make it a reality. Put crudely, if there isn't enough food to go around, equality simply means slow death for everyone, an equality of suffering. Sharing on a sustained basis implies that food is plentiful. Marx and Engels were able to move beyond the utopians for a number of connected reasons. Like other socialists, Marx and Engels saw the tremendous increase in wealth that sprouted up during the rise of industrial capitalism that promised, but did not deliver, a world free of want. But they also witnessed something else: workers' strikes and demonstrations in Germany, Britain, and France. The working class ceased for them to be only a suffering class, and became before their eyes the active agent of its own liberation, the class whose own emancipation could act as the basis for the liberation of all. This is the central component of Marxism, so we'll come back to this. But for now, a couple of points need to be made. The discovery of the working class was an important breakthrough, because it identified a social force capable, through its own actions, of transforming society. Before this point, there had been, roughly speaking, two views about radical social change, and both saw in the mass of the exploited, at best, a passive element that might aid more enlightened minorities to transform society. The radical French 18th century materialists, like the utopians, argued that the mass of the people, as products of their social and material conditions, were incapable of getting beyond it. For how can someone molded by his or her environment step outside that environment to change it? What was required, therefore, was an exceptional man, or a group of enlightened men, standing above or outside society. The fact that these philosophers thought enlightened men would change the world was, ironically, proof that they too were products of the prevailing circumstances. Or even an enlightened despot who would make the change from above. Even radicals, such as the French revolutionary Auguste Blanqui, saw workers as part of more or less unconscious mass that could provide muscle, but not leadership, to the revolution, which would be made by a group of conscious conspirators. idealist thinkers, who believed that great ideas shaped the material world, held equally elitist theories that relegated the masses to either no role whatsoever in historical change, or to a completely passive role. For the left Hegelians in Germany, for example, of whom Marx and Engels were members in the early 1840s, spirit, or ideas or philosophy, was the active element, whereas the material, the mass, was the passive element in social change, if it played any role at all. The point is that most radicals adhered to the great man theory of history. Every great event in history was brought about by the great ideas and great actions of great men. French radical 19th century historian Augustin Thierry ridiculed this approach. Quote, "It is highly singular that the historians stubbornly refused to attribute any spontaneity or creativity to the masses of people. If an entire people migrates and makes itself a new home, that means, our analysts and poets assert, that some hero has taken it into his head to found a new empire to add luster to his name. If a city is established, it is some prince that has given it life. The people, the citizens, are always material for the thinking of a single individual. Do you really wish to learn who founded an institution and who conceived a social enterprise? Search among those who really needed it. It was to them that the first idea of it, the wish to act, and a considerable part of the execution, belonged." End quote. Historians and poets may write history, but it is great masses of people in motion, in particular social classes, that make history. Marx came to this conclusion in a series of notes, or theses, he jotted down in 1845. First, he argued that the materialists who said that people were products of their circumstances, and that to change people you only had to change their circumstances, inevitably divided society into two parts, the passive majority and a thinking elite that could somehow stand outside society. Like the famous behavioral scientist B.F. Skinner, who set up various experiments to elicit certain predictable responses from his subjects, this minority would mold the passive majority by changing its circumstances. Of course, the problem with this view is that the people who are meant to change things are themselves product of their material environment. And so the whole theory breaks down. To the idealists who argued that conditions didn't matter, and that only ideas were important, he argued that ideas without any connection to the real world were immaterial, and therefore incapable of changing social conditions. The validity of any idea about society could only be tested in practice, the practice of masses of people attempting to change society. The way Marx got around this dilemma was to say that historical change could only be conceived as the self-conscious activity of masses of people, that the oppressed change their ideas and their conditions through revolutionary action. Quote, "The coincidence of the changing of circumstances and of human activity, or self-changing, can be conceived and rationally understood only as revolutionary practice." End of chapter 1.